Has anyone signed in?
Senate Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness will come to order. Madam Vice Chair.
Again, I'm reading from the Voices of the Guard. These are veterans. This one is a veteran. And it was Coming Home is the name of the chapter. And he says, coming home was very confusing and very troubling to me because I felt those things. But I didn't know what I was feeling. And it caused a lot of anger and outbursts on my part. I had a lot of friends who turned to drugs and alcohol. Some of them got arrested. I don't drink and I don't do drugs, so instead I isolated myself. That was my coping mechanism. I figured I couldn't cause any problems or get in any trouble if I sat in my room by myself and looked at the internet half the day or played a video game in the corner or read a book. I was afraid to interact with people. I felt like I didn't know how to interact with half the people I knew anymore. My wife was the one who helped me cope and deal with a lot of it. We've gone to counseling. My pastor from church is a former Special Forces soldier from Vietnam, passing knowledge down from one generation to another. And I think it's just important for us to remember, Mr. Chair, that we have people here, even from my era of the Vietnam War, who are still have these feelings about who they are and where they are and their interaction with people. So we always have to keep that in the back of our minds. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Very good wisdom. Colleagues, on terms of the schedule that's in front of you, we're going to do a quick work session on legislative concepts to be introduced very quickly, and then we're sort of going to go down the list that we have in front of us, that the agenda that's posted, with the exception we have some members coming in and out that we have to accommodate for other committees, and then we're actually waiting for legislative revenue staff to help us with the tax credit stuff. With that, I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of introducing legislative concepts.
Chair Boquist, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 3282, dated 1-27-15. LC 3215, dated 1-28-15. LC 3291, dated 2-11-15. LC 3216, dated 2-17-15. LC 3419, dated 2-18-15. LC 3217, dated 2-20-15. And LC 1296, dated 2-20-15.
Madam Vice Chair, Montana Senators, move the legislative concepts as be sure to be introduced as committee bills. Colleagues, I remind you that a vote of introducing a legislative concept is not a vote on the merits of the content of the draft, nor does it guarantee the draft referred back to this committee, nor does it guarantee ultimately will be scheduled. Or, and sometimes introduction measures as a courtesy to get the draft into the pipeline. The seven items are in line for members that want to look at them on OLS. Due to time constraints, we're going to move forward rapidly. Is there discussion? Is there dissent? And so ordered. With that, we're going to close the work session on the introduction of legislative concepts. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 531. Madam Counsel, if you please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 531 allows public employees to compensate deployed employees, stipulates the amount shall not exceed the base salary on the date of employment, declares emergency effective on passage. There is also a dash one amendment that removes the emergency clause.
Good, Senator, please.
Thank you. I'm Senator Fred Girod, Senate District 9. Colleagues, we have a real problem with people that are willing to serve in the military in that they undergo some real financial hardships. And what happened to me was I was contacted by Washington County Sheriff, and within the sheriff's people that he hires, quite a few of them decided that they would go into the military, and they were called up. He would like the ability to supplement their salary. So the working guts of Senate Bill 531 is the second page, and it's sub 6. And I'm just going to read that because it pretty well explains the bill. The state of Oregon, a county, a municipality, or another political subdivision of the state may, underscore may, establish and administer a program that allows an officer or employee who is absent on leave to receive an amount of pay or other emolument that supplements and exceeds any compensation received for performing military duty, provided the amount received by the officer or employee under this subsection does not exceed the amount of base salary the officer or employee was earning on the date the officer or employee began the leave of absence. That's basically the guts of the bill, and it just, as I said, is a may. It's it allows counties like Washington County, and allows the Washington County Sheriff to supplement those salaries of those people that are going abroad to fight. Now, I can't put words in his mouth, but it seemed pretty evident that they draw heavily from the military for the Sheriff's Department, and oftentimes they get recalled. And so this is something that he can do to help those people, but also it helps him because they have a job when they return. So I really think this is a pretty good bill. I would ask you to consideration. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Colleagues? Senator Courtney.
Thank you. Senator, let me ask you a question. I don't have the bill in front of me. So you say may.
Yes.
So it's not mandatory.
That's correct.
And does the language of your bill, and I don't have it.
If you want, I can give you this.
That's quite all right, because I couldn't read it. So, because of my eyes, I'm old. That's why I did it. So, it's on a, you refer to local jurisdictions, May. Is that right?
Chair Boakes, Senator Courtney, this bill would allow it from the state of Oregon or any of its subdivisions, which would include a county, a municipality, and so on.
Well, I'm just going to say this. It's a very good bill. I don't know. There could be an issue here, if you know what I mean. You know, you're one county, you do, the other county, you don't. You mean the state of Oregon? You mean like state troopers? And one, I don't know what you're saying. I just think that we're going to have to work on that. That's just my opinion, Mr. Chair. Right. I think you're going to have to work on that part of the bill. What I'm saying is I'm not so sure it's going to have to be statewide. I'm not sure you're going to be able to allow it. I could be wrong. I could be wrong, Chair. Don't get mad at me. Senator, you can allow it on an individual local government basis. I'm just going to say that. So I don't know, but something about it concerns me. But if you can end up there, that's fine. I just don't know.
Senator Courtney, again, it's a may, so it would, you know, it's arbitrary as to how that would occur. And you're right in the fact that each county would probably have to have their own policy, and it could be just restricted to, like, the sheriff, or in the case of Washington County, or it could include all county employees. It would depend on the county, the jurisdiction from which the vote would be taken.
Paula? Am I sure?
No, I don't know how it will work. I would think everyone would move to, I would advise veterans to move to the county that we're doing that, but.
I do know that several counties during the last decade have done this, and then have been advised that they didn't have the permissive language to do it. And that's the issue, right?
Yeah, by statute, it says they may not do that. So this is the reason for the bill. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, this removes that language and it kind of clarifies it.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Senator Cornett, what we're talking about is classes, correct?
Right, okay. Exactly.
Counsel, for the next meeting, if you would go back to Legislative Council and confirm the permissive language and have them determine the constitutionality in terms of classes.
So explain to me.
It's exactly right.
How does that work? Okay, you have someone who works for a county or the state of Oregon, and
yeah.
And they decide to, they have to leave.
Mm-hmm. Senator Boakes, Chair Boakes, Senator Mona Sanderson, what the bill would allow is that, say that they were currently making $4,000 a month, their military pay was $2,000 a month, it would allow the county or whatever jurisdiction to supplement the other $2,000 a month. And it also keeps their, you know, what they're trying to do is also keep their job open so they have a place to come home to. And so it's really a morale boost for those people from the military, especially in from the sheriff's departments, which they draw on very heavily from. So that was the reason for the bill, but that's how it would work.
Other questions for the good senator? Is there anybody else that wants to testify on this bill? Thank you very much.
The agencies, no agency heads or anybody?
No, because it's permissible. I've been contacted by cities, counties, districts, and various people. Again, permissive language. The private sector already has permissive language and the ability to do that. So, but I do think Senator Courtney raises the issue of class statute, and that needs to be answered, and then the confirmation of permissive language under the statute. With that, we'll close the public hearing on SB 531, and we're going to move to first come serve. Senate Bill 494, we'll open a public hearing. Doc, if you would, please, counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 494 permits the Department of Transportation to renew or replace out-of-state service members' driver's license without a photograph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee. Thanks for letting us kind of jump the line here a little bit. We've got to get to another committee. I think we have one more bill that's up before you that we have to talk about, too, for a moment. Senator Olson will bring that forward, I think, later. I'm a big believer in giving credit where credit is due, so I brought along my legislative aide here, Julia McFadden. She is the one who brought this bill forward, actually, through our office because of a communication received from a veteran who's actually serving overseas right now. He's a fighter pilot, and I'm going to ask her, well, I'm sure she's a little nervous, to present this bill to you real quick.
Thank you, Chair Boquist, senators, representatives. I am a little nervous. But we got a contact from a constituent named Jedediah Johnson. He's 14 years in the Navy. He's an active duty fighter pilot. He was born in Southern Oregon. He identifies as an Oregonian, votes in Oregon, and has been able to renew his driver's license in Oregon up until 2006 was when his last renewal was up. He recently went to renew his driver's license and was told that because of biometrics, which is a new method of taking photographs in order to help prevent identity theft and fraud, that he would actually have to come be present in order to renew his license. This law actually does allow the DMV to make some exceptions. They make exceptions for religious reasons, and they also make exemptions for facial deformities. And this bill is requesting that we actually can make that same exception for active duty military personnel. For Jedediah and his wife, this is more so an issue of home than it is a driver's license issue. It seems that this is where they want to come home to. This is where their family is. And as he's off fighting and they get stationed every couple of years in various places, they want to be able to maintain their residency and to be active in their voting process here in Oregon.
Well, thank you. That sounds very good. You did a good job.
Thank you.
You're probably twitching at your feet down there, right? Amy Joyce is out there somewhere. Okay, come on up. Tell us why we can't do this. I want you to do it in front of Doc Bates. That way I can deal with this.
Chair Boquist and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. I would never tell you that you can't do this bill. And actually, I worked with Ms. McFadden on this issue, and it was an unfortunate coming together of a number of different statutes that hampered over a number of years. The valid without photo statute, it actually is in statute what folks can get this license for, only for religious reasons and facial disfigurement. Then we add on top of that biometrics. And this individual hadn't renewed his license and gotten a photo in something like 16 years. So I would say that I and DMV worked very hard to try to figure out a way to make this work, and under current law, it simply wouldn't work. So Senator Bates brought this bill to fix the problem, and it'll take some minor implementation, and we'd be happy to implement that bill as soon as it's passed.
Mr. Chair, I think I failed to identify myself. I'm Senator Bates, District 3, Southern Oregon. I would say that for those of us who have served in the military and served overseas, you just don't ask for a two-day pass and fly back to the United States to get a picture taken in a DMV situation, which might take a couple of days. And, you know, it's just something that's not practical. These men and women are in this day and age, quite often are in combat zones fighting for our country. This is a small thing we can do for them, make their lives a little less difficult.
Okay, thanks. Senator Olson.
Senator Bates, does this bill allow for a photograph taken overseas to be certified by like a commanding officer and say that that's who it is and then send it to them so that you can use the photograph?
I don't believe it does. I would hope the DMV, once this is in place, would consider, if they could, to do that kind of a process by rule. So we can get it. You know, most of us carried military ID with our pictures on it. When I was in, we had to do it every 2 years, I think, 2 or 3 years. And I would expect he's got a military picture with him somewhere that could be used.
Thank you. Okay. What about your question?
The committee doesn't do is we don't have work sessions on the same days, but we will schedule this for a work session next week. And I would assume that you would be happy to carry it if we pass it out of the committee.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. You did a very good job. Thank you, AP, for jumping up there. With that, colleagues, we're going to close the public hearing on. Is there anybody else that's not signed up that wants to testify? We're going to close the public hearing on SB 494. I think Representative Boone. Representative Boone is here on SB 95. Looking at my list here. We're going to open a public hearing on SB 95. If you would please, counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 95.
This is hand pump fuel.
Requires manually operated fueling systems backup in case of electrical power loss at gas stations unless backup electrical power is available.
You're on.
Good afternoon, Senator Boquist and other senators. I'm Deborah Boone, House District 32, and this bill is, I'm just here to introduce it, and my cohort here, Jay Wilson, will continue with the details. But this bill is part of the Oregon Resilience Plan implementation strategies and one of their top priorities and recommendations from the plan to implement in the case of a disaster. And it's important to note that it's not a mandate. So I'm going to quit at that. I've got another committee. I've got four bills waiting to vote on over there, if you will excuse me. And I'm at your service, if I can, to come back if you need me for any other reason, in hearing room E.
Any other questions for the good representative? No, we'll turn further. You have one?
I have one.
Okay.
Are you coming back for 432?
432? I don't know.
The 911 bill?
What's that?
The 911 bill?
Absolutely.
Can,
if someone can give me a call over there, I'll be there.
That.
Johnny on the spot. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Please go on.
Great. Good afternoon, Senator Boquist, Vice Chair Monas Anderson. As the chairman, Jay Wilson, the chairman of the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission, we support Senate Bill 95. The Oregon Resilience Plan identifies that one of our highest vulnerabilities statewide is liquid fuel, and that the concentration of the reserves for the entire state residing along the mouth of the Willamette River will be in jeopardy when we face our large earthquake. And an image that I have provided as a slide. I think all of you should have a photograph of it. It's a very simple image, but I think it conveys what this reality is about during a disaster, is that fuel is gold. Fuel is precious. And the image is from the Japan tsunami, which occurred almost 4 years ago, and it shows people siphoning gasoline out of a wrecked minivan that's been damaged during the tsunami. But the point being, it emphasizes the issue, is that unless we have the means to get access the fuel that we already have on site, then people are paralyzed. And just simply by having a manual override so that without electricity we have some ability to access fuel so that we can continue emergency operations in these locally isolated areas is something that we support and highly encourage consideration for.
Questions?
Senator Olson? I'd just like to make a comment. I was on the Resilience Task Force, and liquid fuels were way up there at the top, because without them, we can't get around. Emergency vehicles can't get around. And the discussion was centered on the fact that even if we have the fuel in a tanker, we can't get it out because we're not going to get it out of the ground if there's no power. So this is a critical bill. We really need to do this right away.
Okay, so I have a follow-up for you. And at the same time, I'd like Paul Romine and Bob Russell to come up. Okay, so practical application. I mean, the way it's written, it's actually not permissive. So what we're trying to do is figure out, and I think these two gentlemen can help you figure out, is all these bright engineers that were on this group, how did we what was the mechanism? What's the solution? It's easy to say we need this dispensary. We all get that. We got to get out of the ground. But the question is, what is out there in the market of a hand pump? How would you possibly do this? What are the liabilities? All these other things that have prevented us from doing this. What did you guys come up with on the task forces, the mechanism? What is the piece of machinery that would do this?
I apologize, Senator. I can't answer the actual device that's at hand, thinking that there must be a means available either on the market or that could be developed for overriding the fact that we've lost electrical availability. And that dependency on electricity is something we don't want to just throw our hands up and say we can't address this. But I don't know the exact device.
Senator Olson, you have a comment?
Yeah, I did. Some of the discussion we had, of course, is if a tanker comes in on ground, assuming they can get across the road, was that they have this big hose, and it's like a 3 or 4 inch hose that they distribute into the in-ground tanks. The discussion was, how do we convert that larger hose to a smaller hose so that you can directly put it into vehicles? And I think that was the discussion. You know, we talked about manual pumps. We talked about electrical generation. You know, if a tsunami happens, would there be a small portable generator, a $200 piece of equipment that could fuel an electric pump? But the one thing that is all everybody has to remember is, if we can get a small enough hose, gravity feed will take care of most everything, because the tanker is way up in the air. And unless there's a vehicle that's much bigger than that, gravity will push the fuel into any vehicle that's out there. So the discussion is not only on manual pumping, physically pumping, but I would say the discussion needs to be on the size hose so that we can get it into the appropriate tank, you know, such as a gas tank or a fuel tank on a diesel truck.
Okay. Who wants to go first?
I will. He gets to go before me at the next hearing. So.
Okay.
Any filibusters?
We're not on the floor of the Senate yet.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine, an attorney in Portland with the Romaine Group, and I'm here representing the Oregon Fuels Association. First of all, the bill as written is a mandate. It's not a incentive or anything. So it mandates that everybody's supposed to have this. And the way we price this out, if you want to have auxiliary power at a station, it's about $20,000. So it's a very expensive proposition. That's number one. Number two, I remember growing up in the 50s and 60s, and we borrowed gasoline from other places periodically, and we usually did it using a hose in our mouth. But I suppose that won't work in this big of a deal. But if there are incentives to do stuff, are fine. But mandating something that's this expensive, when we really can't remember when we've had a disaster where we've needed anything like this, it's just an additional cost on a station owner. And frankly, we're having a heck of a time keeping stations open, especially in the rural parts of the state and the coast, because the margins on gasoline and diesel are so thin. Maybe if we, I know I'm going to get a glare from somebody who's sitting to your right, but maybe if we coupled this with self-service, we might be able to work out something where we cut a few costs here and there. But I think I'll end my conversation at that point.
Well, I will point out the statute of limitations of drawing fuel with a hose are expired, but probably the statute of limitations of the self-service is not expired. It's not a bad topic to have. Mr. Russell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Association. Actually, I was hoping that this bill was inadvertently written more broadly than intended, because as I read it, my members certainly have diesel fuel tanks both above ground and underground, and they would be swept in to this bill. I can think of other groups also besides just trucking companies that have private fueling facilities that they're not open to the public that would be swept in with this particular language. So I was hoping that perhaps the committee would consider narrowing it so that it just covers Mr. Romaine's clients.
Mr. Chair, we would like to amend that to say that if you really want to get to the trucks that are carrying this fuel, as Senator Olson suggested, that maybe we amend it to just include Mr. Russell's clients.
Okay. Colleagues, questions before I start? Do you have a question?
Yeah. I'm all into prevention. And usually how a state will react is wait for the bad seismic earthquake to occur and then say, oh, yeah, we should have done this, should have done that, et cetera, et cetera. So my point of view is I want you guys at the table to have a I want a community seismic plan, which we're working on. And this is a part of what we really need to be thinking about. And I just don't want industries to say, no, let's just wait until the Big Bang hits, you know. Let's start thinking about that now.
Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, I agree with you on that. And basically, if you're looking about making sure that you can get emergency vehicle service, this basically says everybody who's got a fuel tank is supposed to have a way to get the stuff out. Really, I think what you really want to focus on is making sure that communities have a plan where there is a place where they can get the fuel in a disaster situation. And maybe you narrow the focus to the community itself supporting something in a particular place, various locations around the state, that become the emergency designated area that you go to. But again, this is the introduction of this bill is the first time we have been involved. So, but what you're talking about actually makes a lot of sense for a community to get together, but to have every station around so that, you know, somebody can come down and fill up their Mercedes doesn't really work.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, we totally agree with what you're trying to do. That's not a problem. What we find in the trucking industry is that most of our tanks are now above ground. Because you may recall a number of years ago we had an issue with underground storage tanks leaking, and people have dug the old tanks up, and most of them now are above ground, and they are can be gravity fed, or the fuel can be pumped through gravity in those instances. But according to this bill, they would also be covered. So I guess my real point here has been that I just think the bill needs to be targeted to what you want to accomplish, that the way it's written, it's pretty broad.
Senator Olson, you had a comment?
Yeah, I do. I find it quite interesting that somehow we've interjected a $20,000 electric generator to draw fuel from the ground. It's a manual system. And one would presume, at least my presumption, since I was there and listened to it all, is that you get one of those little hand cranks, you know, you drop the hose down in the tank and you pump it out. I think, as the good senator said, we can work this bill to make certain that it's strictly designed so that, you know, gravity feed works. It would count as a manual operation to get fuel out. The key that I was always struck on is if we were able to haul fuel from Redmond over to here, we can't get it out of the tanker because we have no place to put it. And if we put it into an in-ground tank that doesn't pump, it doesn't do us any good. So another conclusion that I would come to is the fact that we need to have a way where a service station or, and as you said, Mr. Romain, an area specifically designated for fire and emergency to come in, not everybody in their Mercedes to go get fuel. We all will need fuel, but fire life safety comes first, and that we have a way to get that fuel in there. And that, to me, would be a manual pump. You've seen them on the farm pumps. You go like this back and forth, and it pumps fuel. That shouldn't be too difficult. Maybe we just put them in fire stations so when it happens, they can grab the fire station and run over to a service station and get the fuel from any service station in the vicinity. Maybe that's what we should look at.
Let me clarify here just so we kind of got direction here. Forward area refueling point, basically the setup is 20,000. The problem with the hand pump so far that, you know, unless council's got some email, because we've been asking the manufacturers in the last 4 or 5 days to kind of help us out here, is because of the rise, we haven't found a hand pump that'll get it 15 foot out of the bottom of the tank. So the goal is, I think, and if I'm hearing correctly from the Trucking Association and from the Fuel Association, is everybody grasps what the problem is. We just have to come up with a way to first permissive and then start walking down the road and identifying what we need to do to get it out.
Right.
And maybe you guys know better resources than we are, and maybe a pump that will actually pull it up. But being a farmer, I know I can't hand pump it 15 foot out of the tank, out of the ground.
Oh, you're a wuss.
Huh?
You're a wuss.
Well, I can't turn the crank fast enough, right? So you can't impugn the character.
I know.
We're not on the floor, right? So, and so, you know, my thought process right now, Madam Vice Chair, unless you have it, is to try and get, you know, we got two gentlemen here who have the expertise, or at least know who to reach to get the expertise to figure out what is the right intent. Because I believe the intent is emergency preparedness in the future. How do we get it out, get access to the fuel first through trucks and everything else like that? And the reason we've not had this, I'm interested, neither one of you, I do want you to comment, no one said this, but the reason we haven't had this discussion before in the past is everybody's been scared to talk about it because of the liability issues. And so that's kind of a deal there. We haven't even touched that in this bill. If you have this pump and you're going to hand pump it out of the ground, or you're going to come to one of your stations or one of your trucking companies and have to pump it, then the question comes back, if the EMS people are pumping it, who's liable, spills, so on and so forth. If either one of you, you can deny or you can comment on that, but I would ask that if you're interested that we can get a small work group together and kind of brainstorm where this the direction this ought to go to achieve what everybody agrees is the right way to go.
Yeah, we would be more than happy to participate, and we'd ask you to delay the work group just a few days since we have another.
I'm a little busy
bill.
With central assessment and a few other things right now. So.
Yes. Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to participate as well.
Madam Vice Chair, you think? Senator.
I'd be happy to chair the work group.
I'd be happy not for you to chair the work group, so I'll chair the work group.
All right.
You were invited to come, though.
I'll see.
And just so everybody knows, I did receive, actually, support from industry on this, but their question was, do you know anybody that manufactures, as Senator Olson said, a hand pump? And so far, we haven't found anybody. We've actually reached out to multiple entities and said, okay, how do you get it up? And I happen to know something about forward area refueling points, and so far, we haven't found a mechanism other than that fully certified EPA DEQ $20,000 system. But I think there's got to be something out there. And the other thing is do we need to go into a bill? And this is food for thought to bring back. Is you're going to have a backup fuel dispensary. Is, you know, what other quirks need to be done if the EMS or the fire department shows up and then there's a fuel spill, right, or something along that line at the same time. So. If you gentlemen are willing to help, then council will be in touch with you, and then we'll kind of go from there and see how we can best work out a mechanism to go forward. Because fuel is the weakest point. Without fuel, there's no emergency coming. There's no cold beer. I figured out that one. Okay. All those problems. So.
Multiple clients involved now.
Yeah, right. You okay with that?
Very.
Is there anybody else that wants to testify on SB 95? Okay, great. I appreciate it. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on SB 95. Is there any more up? I see Senator Winters here.
No, I remember.
Okay, so.
Get the page.
We have 95 done. 949 is done, right? Okay, and we've done 531. That leaves SCR 6. We're going to open a public hearing on SCR 6, and Senator Winters was going to testify, and then Gloria Welch. Please come up. Council, if you'd explain the bill for us, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SCR 6 is in memoriam for Army Specialist Nicholas S. Welch, who passed away in 2013. I believe... Ms. Welch is the deceased's mother.
Ma'am, welcome to our committee. And the only thing you have to do is state your name, and from there on, we're all yours.
Okay. I'm very nervous.
You have plenty of time, ma'am.
I'm Gloria Welch, and I am the mother to Specialist Nicholas Welch, who was killed in a suicide bombing in Afghanistan. It happened July 23rd, 2013, and he passed away August 6th of 2013. and it was brought to my attention that there has been road signs that's been created for fallen soldiers, which are a lot like the ones that you see sometimes for fallen servicemen, such as police officers and such. And so some families had came together and wanted to try to do that same thing for fallen soldiers. And so they got theirs passed, I believe it was sometime last year, middle of the year, for their sons, and had their freeway signs hung. And it basically is just a nice big sign that recognizes the Fallen Hero Highway Program. It states their name and, I believe, the part of the military that they're associated with. And when it was done then, to my understanding, it was kind of specifically just for their sons the way it was written. So now it's being presented to kind of do it for all. And I just wanted to say a little bit about my son. He was born in 1987, March 16th, to me and my husband, Barry Welch. And he was a very giving person, and he was a very compassionate and loyal son and friend and soldier. And he served for 3 years. Thank you. And he was going to be released from the military. He had served his enlistment time, but he didn't want to leave his comrades that he had served with over in Afghanistan just because his enlistment was over. He felt like he had went there with them to serve and to do a mission, and he didn't want to leave them behind, so he felt like he should stay, so he reenlisted. And very shortly after he reenlisted, he was killed in the bombing. So he didn't make it back with his fellow soldiers. So we, in his honor and all the other fallen heroes out there, who are military associated or any other type of thing, we would like to see this passed in honor of them and to keep their memory going and to let people know on a daily basis that these people are out there fighting for what we have in our country. That's it.
Thank you very much, ma'am. And having unfortunately had to call 20 mothers like you, I understand the loss and the emotion. Madam Vice Chair.
Oh, thank you so much. I think it's really brave to be able to come and tell your story. Cause
I didn't plan on doing it.
No, you're holding up very well. Minute. But this is really important, and I'm so glad that Senator Winters has sponsored this bill for you, for the family, and for the state of Oregon. So thank you so much.
And, ma'am, what we'll do is, I think you heard earlier, we do public hearings 1 week, and then we do work sessions the following week. And either the vice chair or I will be meeting with Senator Winters on this, and then we'll plan on scheduling this in the future. You won't need be able to come. You won't have to come back. If the work session comes up for schedule, you'll be able to see it on OLIS. And then Senator Winters' office will be reaching out and talking to you, too. And, again, we greatly appreciate you coming before the committee and understand how hard it is. Senator Olson.
Thank you. Thank you for your son's service. We have on the House side a bill moving that will allow those highways to be renamed. It was very particular when it was first done, so we're trying to open it up so it makes it a little easier, the process, so that ODOT can come right in and name those sections of highways that are so chosen.
That was my understanding from the families that we spoke with. They said that it was a really long process for them, but kind of the whole reason of doing this is so that it happens more quickly, and
right.
And it allows the family to kind of pick a certain freeway or highway that's, you know, meaningful for them to where it need to be hung.
And again, ma'am, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
With that, colleagues, we're going to close the public hearing on SCR 16 and vote open a public hearing on SB 432. I believe this is actually Senator Olson's bill, if he wants to go down and be formal. And Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 432 reiterates that funds held in the emergency communications account must be used for purposes described in ORS 403-240. It requires statutory change in a fiscal emergency to deviate from the purposes described at that citation. Declares emergency is effective on passage.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Senator Alan Olson. I'm a senator from Senate District 20, which is the heart of Clackamas County. It's quite interesting. In the newspaper of 2/23/15, the USA Today, Statesman Journal, and I will hold this up, it says, in a digital age crisis, 911 may not find you. And it's interesting when they report, and I'll read a portion of this. As water filled her sinking SUV, Chanel Anderson tried the doors. They wouldn't budge. She dialed 911 on her cell phone, telling the operator exactly where she was. Anderson, 31, was delivering newspapers near Atlanta around 4 o'clock in the morning in late December, so she knew the cross streets, even the zip codes. She repeated her location over and over. But it didn't help, because Anderson's call was routed through the nearest cell phone tower to a neighboring county's 911 system. The dispatcher couldn't find the streets on her maps. Worse, the system couldn't get a fix on the cell phone's location before the call ended. In the agonizing final seconds of the call, Anderson's words were muffled by the sounds of pond water. The dispatcher asks the address again and then utters, "I lost her." It is now easier than ever for victims to reach 911, but harder than ever for responders to reach them, as quoted in the newspaper. Colleagues, we have 43 PSAPs, public safety answering points. These are your 911 centers. With the 43 is down from the 49 we've had. And this is sometimes what they hear. 911, what's your emergency? And in response, they hear, "Help me. Help me." I'd imagine that the 911 centers hear these requests quite often. But the interesting thing about the 911 centers is they have the technology if we can afford it. I started working on 911 issues in 2011, in my freshman year. I realized then that sweeping the 911 funds hurts everyone. Imagine yourself or your family member calling 911 and saying, "Help me. Help me." 911 center knows you're there, but they don't know where you're at. Technology changes daily. When I got here 4 years ago as a senator, I had a flip phone. Now I have a phone that's a smartphone. Technology changes daily. We have swept $23,366,598 from the 911 account. It's obvious these funds were needed for something. But consider this. With technology changing so quickly, that $23 million could have gone to keep our 911 centers up to date so that they can find you, so that when you or a loved one says, "Help me," the 911 centers can respond and send people to your point of assistance. We had House Bill 3199 in 2009 that took the interest from the 911 funds and put that into the general fund. That accounted for another $750,000 to $1 million. Now, I understand there are programs that need funding. But remember, this program is a life-saving program. Not only our lives, but police officers and firemen, they all count on the 911 system. And this bill simply states that monies should remain in the 911 account so that when technology changes, we have a bank account to pay for those changes so we can update our 911 system. If we absolutely need the money, there is a checkoff in there that says that the governor can declare a fiscal emergency. and we can then take the money. But until that time, it's too easy to just look at and grab and say, I need it for this program or I need it for that program. This bill allows PSAPs to purchase the new technology needed to match the expanding technology market, such as, once again, my new cell phone. This bill deals with people's lives every day, day in and day out. It's important that we use these monies to protect Oregonians. Thank you very much for your consideration. I'll take any questions.
Rep. Boone.
Thank you. Hello again, Senator Boquist and committee. Deborah Boone, House District 32. And I'm here to support this bill, Senate Bill 432. I think some of you may have seen me up before you on a similar bill several times in the past. And I'm glad that Senator Olson has gone first and given you the details, but I just wanted to add a couple little things to how things work. And for example, when you get a call, a 911 call, on our highway system, there are cutoff points where they use different towers, et cetera, and different dispatch centers will take the call. For example, where I live in my fire district, for example, half a mile from my home, but it stretches quite a bit further into the 19 miles up the highway, it will go through another dispatch center, which isn't as familiar with some of the addresses that can be the same route one box, whatever, and there can be three or four of them in the same county, depending on where they are. And so, or people will be driving through. I live near the coast. They're going back and forth on Highway 26 to the coast, and they're not sure where they are, so they'll say, there's a car crash, there's this, there's that. Somebody laying in the street the other day and was having a heart attack. He got out of his car. He felt ill and collapsed on the side of the road, so they didn't know if he was hit or sick or what, but they didn't know where to send it. Milepost something, and they thought they were 5 miles, but they were way out of the area. The 911 funds are paid by the 75-cent fee on our phone bills for 911 purposes, and I think that's what people expect them to go to. And when the fund gets up so far, as Senator Olson pointed out, sometimes it gets swept by our budget folks, who then take it and backfill another budget or put it in the general fund, and it shortens the amount of money we have to buy this new technology, et cetera. So one of the things that they were doing that has, in some people's opinion, has helped, in others it hasn't, but is reducing the number of total PSAPs in the state and giving them each a little bit bigger region to cover. They would need the more digital technology works better. So I guess in a word, I support it. I hope you will too. I think it does the right thing. It gives an off-ramp for using the money if it's necessary in an emergency. Thank you.
Ambassador, your question. Thank you. Next panel, appreciate your testimony. Next panel is Mark Tennyson and Sean McCormick. You guys know the drill.
Absolutely. Chair Boquist, members of the committee, my name is Sean McCormick. I'm a policy advisor with the Oregon Military Department, and I'm here today to offer our full support for Senate Bill 432. From our perspective, the goal of Senate Bill 432 is really quite simple. It makes sure that monies that are meant to maintain, manage, and enhance statewide 911 services are actually going to be there when we need them. These funds help ensure that our 43 public safety answering points are staffed and equipped to provide critical life safety services to every citizen and traveler across this state. Additionally, should a key recommendation in the governor's 15-17 budget be approved, a portion of these funds are going to be used to transition all of our PSAPs off of an end-of-life analog network and onto a state-of-the-art digital network. This project is the first phase in transitioning the state to a true next-generation 911 environment, one where text messages and videos will be able to be sent as part of a 911 call. But the success of this project and the ones that we hope will follow are really dependent on having 911 monies available for use. As the good senator pointed out, there have been multiple attempts over the years to redirect 911 funds for other uses, with three of those attempts having been successful. Additionally, all of the interest on 911 currently reverts back to the state. state general fund for other uses. These redirections are really water under the bridge as far as we're concerned. But future proposed alternate uses of 911 funds do really need to be looked at by their impact to critical life safety services for the state. The organization does want to thank Senator Olson and Representative Boone for their efforts to champion this legislation. They've both fought this fight many times for our PSAPs, and we do want to thank the chair for allowing the bill to be heard. So in conclusion, I just want to say that the military department is in full support of Senate Bill 432, and we'll do everything within our power to make it successful. With me today is Mark Tennyson, the section director for 911 services, and I'll be happy to answer any questions at the conclusion of his testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. As John said, I'm Mark Tennyson with Office of Emergency Management and the director of the state 911 program at OEM. I also am here today in full support of Senate Bill 432. The 911 excise tax on average supports approximately only 25% of a public safety answering point's total budget. So the other 75% has to be borne at the local level. Obviously, every penny of the state tax is relied upon by the 43 PSAPs in order to help maintain and update, when necessary, our 911 call-taking equipment, as well as the networks that support those calls and other caller location information. As Sean mentioned previously, there have been multiple attempts over the last several years to redirect 911 funds for other uses, with three of those attempts being successful. Additionally, all interest earned on 911 funds currently reverts to the state general fund for other purposes. That's important because the fact that that happens today makes Oregon ineligible to receive grant funding from federal 911 grant programs established by the NET. That's the New and Emerging Technology, the NET Act improvement that was passed into law in 2008. As the nation moves forward with broadband and communication initiatives, we need to position ourselves should opportunities arise for monies, whether they are for grants or other sources, become available to support our transition to next generation 911. I also would like to thank Senator Olson for his support in bringing this bill forward, and our team is in full support of the bill as well. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
I'd like to make a correction to the record. I said 23 million. It should be closer to 15 million.
Thank you. No questions. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Last panel is Brant Wolf and Barb Young. And I just for the record note that, you know, one of the problems we've had in the past is we've been saving some of this money to go to next generation, and about every time we get to where we want to, we're able to purchase, we've unfortunately had the funds go someplace else.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brant Wolf. I represent the Oregon Telecommunications Association. We represent landline-based telephone companies that operate throughout the state. We're here in support of Senate Bill 432. This is good public policy. This is a good bill. The industry supports it. We ask this committee vote it out to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Barb.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, my name is Barb Young. I'm the legislative director for CenturyLink. And just to kind of do a ditto to Brant. As a major tax collector for this tax in the state, come at a little bit different perspective in that on our customer bills, it states 911 tax. So we fully support this bill and that 911 tax should be used for 911. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of this panel? If not, thank you very much.
Can I ask a question?
Alt Senator Courtney does
have a question. Yeah, so it's just the last panel.
What?
Just the last witnesses.
His last panel.
Yeah, I don't want to engage in a discussion about whether the money that was swept is good or bad, went to good or bad reasons. The sweeping of funds is something that goes on and on, and without, outside of being in the bowels of the building and dealing with budgets and given where the economy is at given times in my 30-year career, you make value decisions. But I am taken after serving under the tutelage of the great Colonel Boquist and Lieutenant Monis Anderson and Master Sergeant Olson, that this probably is a good idea. The thing I couldn't get from any of your testimonies, and I guess all of you know about this, and I didn't quite get the magnitude of it until last night, which I continually do when I go home, and it's not good for my health. I watch the NBC News, and then I always go to CNN and Fox News, and that completely destroys me. That's why I can't sleep at night, because there's news and there's opinion, and it drives me crazy. My wife begs me not to do that, but I do it. Because she goes to bed, she just, even my dog watches it with me. But it's being reported last night in really dramatic fashion. You know where I'm going to go, don't you? That they actually showed a call being made in a 911 call center. And when they put it on the screen, the call was coming in a half mile away from where the guy was standing overlooking the call center. That's how inaccurate now 911 is, apparently. They can't even get the calls, apparently, to the locations. And when you've got people receiving the calls that don't know an area. And so this emerging technology, it's sort of like you can't talk about towers or dishes anymore. You got to talk about the satellites. Now, I'm a layperson. You're not. You know how to use the phrase emerging technology. That means something to 3U. I don't understand what that's all about. But what I am concerned about is the accusation has now been made, you be sure, that because they swept all these funds, I mean, does that mean that our system is, what, 5 miles away from when the call is coming in, or do you have any feel for how bad it is? In my organ, that's what I would like to know in terms of the technology, which apparently, according to these national news agencies last night, is alarming. It is alarming. And I assume all of you know but me what's going on.
Well, if this panel isn't capable of answering that, but we can get OEM to come back up here and address that issue. Unless the two of you want to just jump into the firing pan.
Well, I can make a comment. We represent landline telephone companies, and I can guarantee you, if you're in your house and you dial 911, they will find you. They know exactly where you are.
So, other parts of the nation, they don't know what they're doing, and we do.
Landline. Right. If you have a wireless phone, so and you're depending on that. Then, if you're in your home.
So the woman who drowned in the van doing some emergency service, she was on her cell phone. They got to her 20 minutes later. She'd already drowned. That was a cell phone.
Yes, sir.
Had it been a landline, I'm set. Right.
Absolutely.
So as long as I'm calling my landline, they got my home under control.
That's right.
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 Even though, okay. So what you're telling me tonight is that if I get in trouble in my house, not that you would care.
No,
and
I
they're breaking in, and I make my call. Don't pick up the phone next to me. Go to the cell phone. That's what you're telling me.
No,
go to the landline.
Go to the landline.
Go to the landline.
So even though I'm half asleep, I don't know what I'm doing, I got to go to the landline. Is that what you're telling me?
That's exactly what I'm telling you.
There aren't any more landlines out there, though. Isn't that pretty much the case?
Hopefully you have
Mr.
one.
Mr. Chair.
If you're in an accident, a car, it goes into a lake, you got a problem getting a landline, don't you?
Yes, sir. You do. If you have your landline telephone and you're in your home and you have an emergency, you don't have to talk. Just dial 911 and throw it on the floor and you're good to go. But if you have a wireless
throw it on
device,
the floor. Don't even talk. Throw it on the floor.
They will find you if you dial 911.
Keep the connection open. Here's the problem, though, Mr. President, and you guys can go now.
Thank you.
Emergency services can come back up here. The problem we have is 6 years ago, an example, and I'm going to use the good vice chairs because I know these numbers and she'll get mad at me later, but as an example, we had a district out in Troutdale that averaged 68,000 landlines. That's landline phones in which you could call 68,000 times from a ground phone with a wire and they would tell it is. The problem, though, is that same area only has about 8,000 landlines now and everybody else is in cell phone technology. It's the cell phone technology that you need to get into the 21st century, and that's the problem we're having. We have successfully, because we've taken money out of this fund and helped upgrade it through mergers. We used to have 49 centers. As an incentive, we've been saving money in this fund and helping centers merge together and go to the technology so your phone right there can receive a Tomahawk missile right there on that desk. So they know exactly where you are. The problem we have is that we're doing it piece by piece by piece, and we still have a large section, which these gentlemen can address, of the PSAPs that are older that have the older technology. Only the merger down from 49 to where we are now has been, we've been merging by putting that technology together. So the good senator's question really is how many of these centers out there still are in old technology versus how many are in new technology?
Well, Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Stecky, formerly the director of the Office of Emergency Management, now the deputy director for the Oregon Military Department. And your initial comments about the technology of the telcos is spot on. We're really at the mercy of the telephone companies in terms of the cell phone coverage, in terms of being able to provide that location accuracy as it applies to a cell phone. The actual home phone is completely accurate, but unless we dot and blanket this nation with these cell phone towers that you see up and down the roads, that accuracy is going to be suspect. We're going to need to make certain that the network gets provided or gets updated. The telco network is a collaborative effort with those telephone companies to ensure that we are able to make certain that that location accuracy is complete. Senator Courtney's question about money in relation to the cell phone coverage. It is a very difficult question in terms of trying to make certain that did this additional money, would this equal a better location capability within the state of Oregon? What we have attempted to display is that we want to build up our equipment account. If we can build up that 35% account that the 75 cents goes to, then we can eventually transition to next generation. And that next generation capability will provide a greater location accuracy or capability within the state of Oregon.
Senator Boquist, Senator Courtney, to further members of the committee, to further expand on that, the money in the for the next gen will definitely help improve technology. It will allow new technology that it's not new technology, but that can't be received at all today at a 911 call center. Text messages, video, photos, things like that. Today, that's what next gen will bring us in the future. Back on the question, Senator Courtney, about the wireless accuracy, I also saw the story last night on the news that you did. What Mr. Wolf, Brant Wolf, alluded to before is spot on. Wireline is much different than wireless. The accuracy is not there. The FCC has been mandating, as that story said last night, about improving the wireless accuracy, both indoor and outdoor, with the wireless carriers. So there will be a collaborative effort. There will be money that will need to be expended to update the 911 network. There also will be money that will need to be invested on the wireless carriers network as well to update their cell phone towers that will help with that wireless accuracy.
Introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. For the record, I'm Mark Tennyson with OEM.
Well, I don't want to.
This is an interesting topic. What we're trying to do is consolidate these things.
What I want to do is I'm trying to make your case, Master Sergeant Olson and Representative. I'm trying to make your case. I don't want to use the legal because I don't know what they're saying. Let me just say what I'm saying. Apparently, I think if you did a poll, in my humble opinion, the kind of polls we do, we're trying to kill each other in the campaign, very expensive polls, and you asked Oregonians if they're going to call 911, they better get their landline, or they're taking a chance that people don't even know where they are, they would have no idea that's the case. That's my opinion. They would not know that. Mm-hmm. That's serious. Number two, I still can't for the life of me figure out whether if I use this cell phone right now, and I don't say state capital, let's just say I give a street address here, and they go on, they got these screens in front of them? Is that what they got? They got the screens. And it shows up. Will it be right here where I'm sitting, or will it be somewhere on the other side of Willamette or someplace they call it? I don't know that. I can't tell from what they're saying. And I don't want to talk about that. I don't deal with that. You're wonderful people. You all know what you're doing. If that is the case, if I use this cell phone right here, then I still don't know how long it's going to take the certified smarts to make sure that if I use this phone, it goes right here, and how much that's going to cost. That's the thing I don't have any idea in terms of this discussion. Well, and that is a compelling reason enough, in my opinion, to say with any money you got here, it ought to all be going there, because otherwise our people don't have a 911 system. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
Isn't that right?
That's correct.
All right. So I don't want to do anything further. It's just a public hearing. I'm just reacting.
2 points. Earlier, when I was appointed to work on the 911 system, we were able to pass the multi-line technology bill.
Yeah, correct.
And that multi-line technology bill says that anywhere in a building, a new building perhaps, that you pick up a telephone, a landline telephone, we know that call will come from the fourth floor, room 420. So we've identified that. The problem is, sir, is that as we sweep these funds, we can't keep this technology up to date. And you're absolutely correct. You know, there are these monies are built up. We have a piggy bank, and we put it in there, and we finally say we've got enough. We need to go buy this stuff. And when we do that, we've taken the funds away for other important reasons. I'm not saying they're not important, but we've taken it away, and so therefore we have a further lag in how we can catch up to technology. And when we get money built back up again, we can only move ahead 3 feet instead of 6 feet. And that's the, to me, that's the importance of this bill.
so that we can move ahead, so that tomorrow if you dial your cell phone and you dial 911, they can drive right to you.
You said if I die.
No, I said
dial.
If you dial.
Oh, dial.
Dial.
Dial. Dial.
No, you're going to die from a heart attack if you keep watching.
Oh, yeah, you guys. I was sort of hoping to get there before, but that's
right, right.
Well, I can say that's fine. I, my point, you're not getting my point. People are increasingly, they don't use landlines. Many of my friends
absolutely
have no line. This is what they depend upon. I don't think they have any idea that they're taking a chance with this in terms of 911. I don't think most Oregonians know that. And if you say they do, I'll accept it. I don't think they understand the magnitude of what we're talking about here.
I agree with you, sir. I don't think they do know, but they do know that when they dial 911, they expect it to respond.
I get that.
And without the funding, they can't respond because they can't find them. They ping the towers, and they get to a general
But I think it's
location.
Even more profound than that, is that the poor people that we yell out to taking these calls, they're incapable of really telling exactly where it's coming from. If you know what I'm saying,
right.
They're not incompetent. They can't. They can only get so close, and it's not close enough in some circumstances. That's all I'm saying. I'm done.
So the importance then is that I would assume that you would agree we need to save these monies and put them into the new technologies. Is that what you're saying, sir?
What? I've already made my
statement.
I already made my statement.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
He's a help to me. He's a mean person. Disappointed.
Okay, so this topic will obviously come up again. Everybody's pretty well expressed their position. I think the only two options that we really have is to do something sort of what we've proposed here, which is to save our money, for a better word, in Senator Olson's deal, in our piggy bank to buy it. Or the flip side is, which we don't really have a statute to do, is go out and bond money, buy the equipment, and then use this to pay it back. And I think everybody's advocating at this point, save a little bit of our money so we can buy this and not bond. With that, we're going to close the public hearing in SB 432, and we're going to open a public hearing on SB 53, 54, and 434 combined together. Senator Olson, if you want to, after council speaks, talk about 434, and then we're going to ask Chris to come up with some of the other people.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 432. Excuse me, sir, 434. Exempts from taxation up to $60,000 of the assessed value of home or personal property of a veteran with a service-connected disability of 100%, extends that property tax exemption to surviving spouses who remarry for the first time at age 57 or older. And if I'll take a moment with the background, the property tax exemptions that currently exist, there are two, up to $15,000 for at least 40% disabled, whether or not it's service-connected, and up to $18,000 of assessed value for a service-connected disability of at least 40%. This measure, Senate Bill 434, would add a third level, that is, at up to $60,000 of the assessed value for the highest level of a service-connected disability. And each of those three levels, this measure would make available to be claimed by the surviving spouse, even if they remarried, whereas now it's only available unless they remarry at the two lower levels. And if they remarry, so long as it's remarriage for the first time at the age of 57 or older.
Senator Olson, you want to make comments?
No, I'd like to testify.
Okay.
Is that right?
Sure.
And there is a subsequent referral, excuse me, to Finance and Revenue on this one.
All of these are. They're all going down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name, once again, is Senator Alan Olson. I represent Senate District 20, which is the heart of Clackamas County. This bill specifically deals with 100% disabled veterans. These veterans have sacrificed their freedom from pain and suffering for our freedoms. I think we owe them something for that. I've contacted all the counties. 22 responded. Most showed a little consternation, realizing that, in fact, it would cost them a little bit of money. They could not definitively say how many 100% disabled veterans they had. The assumption that we've used from Department of Veterans Affairs is the fact that about 60% of those veterans that are 100% disabled would own a home. I think this is important because it does reduce the number of size of the displacement of dollars away from the counties, and it's difficult to put an exact number on that. Veterans that are 100% disabled, most of them are don't work, and they get their income from the federal government.
The federal government has been slow in increasing their salaries and what they earn, but their property taxes continue to go on. Their homes typically have been modified for their use so that they can get around easily and do those things that most of us don't have to worry about. We can walk up and down stairs, they can't. They need to have ramps. We can walk into a shower, they need assistance, so they have special showers. They have wider doors to get their wheelchairs through. I was going to talk about a gentleman that lives in my community and I know very well. And it was rather interesting. There was a film on OPB about the battles in Vietnam, and this gentleman was a photographer, and he would go out and make films of the battle. And in the films of this battle, another photographer spotted and saw the mortar hit his foxhole and throw him out, and he lived. And he's 100% disabled today, and this would benefit him. This would benefit my friend and my constituent. I think that the importance of this bill goes back to what do we do for our veterans? We have a lot coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan with the new body armor, with the new forms of destruction that our enemies have figured out with IEDs. A lot of these gentlemen come back 100% disabled. We need to support them. I will point out in the bill itself, I'm not quite certain. I guess it's I could be naive, but I think that in this bill we talk about surviving spouses getting remarried. On line 19, page 2, it says if a surviving spouse of a veteran remarries at the age of 56 years or younger after the death of the veteran, the exemption applies to the period before the date on which the surviving spouse remarries and ends at the date of remarriage. So I'm not certain if this doesn't indicate that once she remarries this tax exemption exists. I believe it does. That was the intent of it. If it doesn't, we certainly should amend it to make it that way so it doesn't carry on in perpetuity. But I would say that for our veterans returning, this is a good bill. They've earned it. I ask you to support it.
Questions? So you're saying that once the veteran remarries, the exemption should go away?
The spouse of the veteran, ma'am. The spouse of the veteran. I believe that the spouse of the veteran.
The
spouse of the veteran. They're allowed the exemption also, and
even though they remarry.
Right, but no. Once they remarry, it will go away.
Yeah, that's what I thought you said.
Okay. Am I correct in that, Counselor?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, members of the committee. Just to clarify, the surviving spouse may claim, even if they remarry, so long as the remarriage is for the first time after the age of 56. So they would not be able to claim it if they remarried for the first time, second time, third time,
okay,
and they were under 57.
Thank you.
Is that your intent?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, so I'll ask you to check with counsel afterwards and LC so that we figure out what exactly the intent is. Other questions? Okay, with that, thank you very much, Senator. With that, I'm going to ask Department of Veterans Affairs to come up. Rural Health's out here someplace, right?
Right now, you'll be right back.
Okay, so Veterans Affairs can come up. Chris, would you come up too, please? What we're going to do, colleagues and members, we have these three tax credit bills with us, which we're going to do something with by next week. We did ask, Chris was here before and kind of went through the TRICARE and went through the tax credit and went through the tax credit for veteran home residents. We had questions in terms of how many people were actually being claimants, who were the types of providers. Were we having full providers providing or just doctors? And so we asked everyone to have clarity because Chris here and his other committee needs to have the answers to these questions and what we're going to do on these three bills here very shortly so those committees can do their actions. So I think maybe we'll start with Rural Health. If you'd kind of give us a little bit of background on the – which one?
Senate Bill 53, sir.
On Senate Bill 53, which is the tax credit for TRICARE. And then I think Chris can also jump in because he's got a little schematic here.
So. Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Dumegg. I'm with the Oregon Office of Rural Health. Our office was responsible for certifying qualified providers for this particular tax credit. It was created And each year, beginning in 2008, we were given a limited number of certifications we could give to providers each of those years. In 2008, it was 500 certifications. In 2009, it was 1,000. In 2010, it was 1,500. In 2011, it was 2,000. I've supplied maps for the last 2 years that show you the number of MDDOs, PAs, and NPs, and where across the state they were actually located. Our office didn't play a role in the development of this at all. We were just sort of given it to figure out how to administer. It was somewhat complicated, and I don't know that I can say it always met all of its goals. I believe the goal behind it was to increase the number of providers seeing TRICARE patients. This brought in some, and it gave a tax credit to those that were already seeing it. And again, it was both an urban and a rural credit. We, again, were only giving the certifications of eligibility. We can't tell you exactly how much people took. That would be Chris. And I would say that the data that we got was from TRICARE itself, or TriWest. So there was no application process built into this, and it was kind of on a first-come, first-serve. So we only had authorization to give certifications until 2011, and at that time we stopped doing that, and we haven't been certifying anyone for this tax credit since.
Questions?
Well, I'm confused as to, I know you haven't given it. Is this a good tax credit?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Anderson, I guess it depends on your perspective. I don't know that it was the most effective tax credit that was given, you know, from our perspective. We have not heard any comments from anybody since we quit giving the certifications.
Thank you.
Follow-up, please. Follow-up. So is this means tested in any manner?
Mr. Chair, no, it's not.
Is there a mechanism in which we could means test it, and you opened your mouth and slid your foot and said this wasn't necessarily the best way? What's the better way?
Mr. Chair, I would probably look to Chris to talk about means testing and whether that's possible. There could be ways of doing this if there was an application process by which providers applied and there was some additional information and some parameters we could set around it, including whether they're already receiving, in the rural case, a rural provider tax credit. So I think with some thought, we could probably come up with a way to do that. But as far as means testing, I would have to refer to Chris. He knows all the money things.
Now I'm confused regarding the rural tax credit, because that's in my committee.
Correct.
And so you're saying instead of giving a TRICARE tax credit, it somehow can be?
Madam Chair, Senator Moses Anderson, I was just saying that I'm not sure if some of these providers were getting both.
Yes,
I don't know
exactly
the answer to that question.
Chris, you presented this, right? So
yes.
Jump in.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Allen, Legislative Revenue Office. So I did put together, there's a one-pager, there are three charts on there. And trying to get back to the policy intent of the tax credit, presumably it's to expand health care access to veterans and their families. And thinking along those lines and trying to access the information that we had, I accessed with the Department of Revenue the tax returns. And so I'm just going to walk through these charts to set up this conversation. And my line of thinking there was trying to get at whether or not it actually increased access and increased the number of providers providing health care to veterans. So the first chart there shows a comparison of the number of people who took the tax credit compared to the number of tax credit certificates that were allowed under law. And as Bob said, it was 500 in 2008 and then increased by 500 in 2008 and then increased by 500 each year. And so that top chart, that first bar there, 2008, 229 tax credits were granted out of the 500 possible. So it was at 46%, and throughout this it was about 50%. And in 2007, the caps were put in place as a safeguard against a tax credit costing a lot more than the estimates that were made in the 07 session. But throughout the 4 years that the tax credit was in existence, it, we never hit that cap. We were always at about 50%. And that's what the solid blue portion of the bars are, the certain tax credits that were granted, and then the outline blue is the total that could have been claimed. The middle chart there is trying to get at the notion of a kind of churning, how many people were taking the tax credit in and out, if they claimed it for a number of years or just a certain year. And so in 2008, of those 229 people who claimed the tax credit, 180 continued to claim the tax credit in either 2009, 2010, or 2011, but 49 of them never claimed it again after 2008. We don't know exactly why, but presumably they just didn't meet the criteria. They were no longer eligible for the tax credit, meaning that they didn't see the number of required patients. And then 2009, out of the 533 people who claimed the tax credits, 90 of them never claimed it again. And by never, it's just 2010 and 2011. And then in 2010, 200 of the 755 people who claimed it did not claim it in 2011. And then, as Bob said, it hasn't been granted since 2012. Arguably, that was a drafting error in the way the credit was installed, because I don't believe I was there in 2007, and my understanding of the intent was not to eliminate the credit after 2011. It was to ramp up the total certifications and then have it plateau at the 2000. In the bottom chart there, and I apologize for the complication here, but I'll try to walk through this. The tax credit was somewhat unique in that if it was the first time a provider was accepting TRICARE insurance, they got a larger tax credit. They got a $2,500 tax credit. If they had already accepted TRICARE insurance, they only got a $1,000 credit the first year that they claimed it. And subsequently, everybody got a $1,000 credit. So through this structure, we're actually able to use tax return data to figure out which taxpayers were brand new to accepting TRICARE. So in 2008, all of the 229 people claimed the tax credit for the first time. That was the first year that the tax credit existed. Mm-hmm. 68 of them had not accepted TRICARE prior to the credit, but 161 of them did accept TRICARE insurance. And so then in 2009, of the 533 people claiming the credit, 154 claimed and accepted TRICARE for the first time, and that's the red bar. So the number of providers accepting TRICARE for the first time went from 68 to 154 to 149 to 229 over the course of those years. The green bars, or the middle ones, if you're looking at it in black and white, were the providers who claimed the credit for the first time but had accepted TRICARE prior to that, so they weren't eligible for the $2,500 credit. And that number went from 161 to 232, 219, and 340. And then the bottom bar, which didn't exist in 2008, the blue one, those are the people who claimed the credit in prior years. So this gives us some sense of the number of providers who were brand new to accepting TRICARE, which I believe was part of the intent, if not the intent, of the tax credit policy, was to get providers who were not accepting TRICARE insurance to accept TRICARE insurance. Now, there's a lot of information that's not provided in the tax return, because all we really know is whether or not they had claimed the credit and for which years they had claimed the credit. And I'm assuming that the tax compliance, I'm making some assumptions about tax compliance here as well, because this is information just from the tax returns, not through talking with any of the providers. But ideally, or presumably, that red bar, that top piece, are the people that were the focus of the tax credit. But in creating a tax credit, it gets opened up to everybody who meets the eligibility requirements.
So then a question here. I mean, this is a tax credit that we have right now, and you're saying the last time they actually could take it was 2012.
2011. And I believe there may have been a drafting error in the switching of sunset dates, because when the original bill was put in place, and I'm kind of working from memory here, the sunset date was January 1, 2012. And so the way the statute reads is that in 2008, the Office of Rural Health could issue 500 tax credit certificates, going up to 2,000 by 2011. and then through the legislative process of the sunset moving to 2016, the other language that didn't follow through was an increase or clarification that more tax credits could be issued in tax years 2012, 13, 14, and 15. And so the interpretation of the statute was that no tax credits could be issued in 2012.
Or 13 or 14.
Or 13 or 14.
So at the moment, this tax credit isn't being utilized at all.
Correct.
Correct? You want to jump into the conversation here? No, you want to stay out of this one. Yeah. Smart move. Okay. So and what is, because I don't see it on here, and you know this off the top here, what is the estimated cost of this tax credit, let's say hypothetically, were it extended in its proper form?
About $3.5 million for 15-17, and then about $5 million in out biennia, and that includes assumptions about participation rates, just going off existing, the 4 years that it was in existence.
Okay, so back to rural health. The question here is has your phone rang off the hook?
Mr. Chair, no, not at all. We've not heard any comments since the tax credit has ended.
And Chris, is there any way, without, you know, getting in trouble, and I know somebody's getting in trouble already for this and a related issue, to figure out who these people are, what category of earners these are? I mean, who's claiming these things? Are these rural providers, you know, making house payments, getting by, and trying to figure out why they moved to Burns, or are these doctors at Eagle Crest making $1 million a year?
There, some of that, Chair Book, with some of that information, I'm thumbing through this report here.
And we have your report in front of us here, too.
Is it this chair? Mr. Chair, I would just say that on the map from 2011, out of that group of MDs and DOs, 188 of them were in Portland. So it is spread throughout the state.
And we can, I don't have it at my fingertips, but I can give you the information by the amount of income that they have that they claim.
Means testing.
Means test it.
I think members would probably want to see what a means test looks like. Am I correct, Madam Vice Chair?
Sure.
Okay.
I do have, okay. What I want to look at, are there complaints from our TRICARE people that providers aren't seeing them? I think that was the reason for getting this at the beginning. And at this point, who has that information? Are there TRICARE people that are having problems getting a physician? Now, if you have Medicare, you have a real issue in trying to get a physician to take care of you. So is the same kind of problem happening? Should we be giving incentives to physicians to take Medicare? That's the question I want to get. Are veterans or our military people having problems getting a provider? Primary care provider.
Jump in, please.
I'm not sure if I want to. Chair Boquist, Senator Monis Anderson. For the record, my name's Laurie Skelman. I'm with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I will attempt to get some accurate information about that for you, Senator. I don't know right off the top what kind of problems there are, if any. So, but I can certainly research that and get back to the committee on that.
Thank you.
Okay, so the next is tax credit for veteran homes residents. We had this discussion last time around when we had an opportunity, and I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Madam Vice Chair, the question we were trying to figure out, even though there was a handful of them, are these doctors, are these, who are providing, who are getting these tax credits, and why? Veterans home.
For the record, my name is Laurie Skelman. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And as Senator Boquist said at a hearing a couple of weeks ago, we were asked to get back to the committee with some information on the impact of these tax credits for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs home in the Dalles. And I prepared a statement with questions and answers for the committee and provided that to the committee. I'll briefly go through it. The first question was whether it was difficult to get physicians in the Dalles to provide services at the veterans' home. And according to those at the veterans' home, and that's where we got this information, that it was difficult. There is a shortage of physicians in that particular geographical area, and it's a challenge to get physicians there because they have to leave their office, travel up to the home, which is a little ways from downtown the Dalles, and so it's for a relatively small reimbursement, it's kind of time consuming to get the physicians up there. There are three physicians currently who regularly visit the veterans home in the Dalles. The most that the home has had at one time on a regular basis was six, sort of the lack of physicians, some of that has come through retirement or moving out of the community. Another question was, do most physicians that provide medical services ask for a letter from the home? That's the process that in order to get the tax credit, they have to get a letter from the administrator at the home to provide with their tax returns. Yes, all the current physicians who visit residents ask for a letter so they can apply for the credit. Historically, almost all physicians who provide services have asked for such a letter. The last question was, has having the tax credit for physicians been a benefit to the home? That is, has it made a difference? It has been in effect for 8 years now, and the answer was yes. It's had a very positive impact in bringing in and keeping physicians. The veterans home has concerns that the tax credit was no longer available. Physicians may take that cost into consideration when determining whether to travel to the home. And because there are currently only three physicians visiting the home, the loss of even one physician would be a hardship. So thank you for this opportunity. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
How much does this cost us? I can't remember if you...
$20,000 you said last time, Chris, I think.
Was it $20,000?
Yes, that's correct.
So my question is, not to be the evil one here, but did I hear you correctly that there's only three individuals that are receiving this tax credit, or did I catch that correctly?
That's right.
From tax return information, it varies over the years. It's varied between 7 and 12.
Okay.
But I thought...
Follow-up.
You have to have a letter from the home... And you say right now we have three physicians that are seeing us. So it should be just three people getting that credit this year or the 2014. Or does the number of physicians vary?
Who are working in the home?
Senator DeBoquist, Senator Dermonis Anderson, yes, it would vary. But there are three regular physicians who are visiting the home at this time. One of the things to sort of consider is that tax returns are at least the data from tax returns are at least a year behind.
Mm-hmm. We would only have data for 2013.
The data that we have for right now, is that correct?
Correct.
So you have data for
the range that I was referring to was between tax years 08 and 12. 2013 is we'll have that in the few weeks. So there is a lag to that information.
So does one physician see one patient once a year or twice a year and then claim the credit, or are these physicians that are there on a routine basis, not necessarily daily, but
the credit is up to $5,000, and it's $1,000 for every 8 residents that they provide care for.
Okay.
And there are some requirements about not canceling appointments and so forth, but it's $1,000 per 8 is one way to think about it.
Other questions? Okay. Chris, I know it's not your bailiwick, but you can take back to somebody here. 434 has a county revenue impact, I do believe. And would we not, would LRO not be able to tell us in terms of 434, which is the 100% disability, you guys would be able to run something up on the counties? Somebody in your office?
Yeah, we should be able to do that. There are certain benefits to disabled veterans now, I think, within the tax property tax system. And so that would be the, I'm thinking off the top of my head, that would be the core of the information that we could use to provide an estimate.
And Senator Olson, do you want to see that estimate?
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing you need to take into account, though, is, you know, that not all 100% disabled, which are very difficult to determine per county, own homes. So I don't know exactly how we, even the counties can't figure it out.
Right.
Yes, we would start with that information, and then I haven't read Senate Bill 434, but we would, and it would actually be a colleague in the office who's okay. working on property right. taxes, but there would be an estimation process, and we would be very clear about the assumptions that we make, and so that if there are concerns about any of those assumptions, we'd be able to revisit those.
Thank you.
Okay, is there anyone else that wants to testify on 53, 54, or 432? Okay.
430.
You.
434.
I'm looking.
434.
For the public hearing on
434. 434. I'm looking here. Am I in the right place here? Carrying over. Yeah, property. Did you want to talk about 434?
Yes, sir.
Please jump in.
Again, for the record, my name is Laurie Skillman with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Senator Boquist, members of the committee, I just wanted to provide some sort of big picture information about this particular bill. Just in terms of across 50 states, almost all have some kind of property tax exemption for disabled veterans. And as you know, Oregon currently gives a property tax exemption for veterans who are 40% disabled and above. And this particular bill has a special provision for those at 100% disability. It's challenging to compare all states, but there are some more generous to a smaller group, the 100% disabled, and some only provide a tax benefit to those that are 100% disabled. Some provide, it's all over the map for the states. We have a good exemption, but we've seen some 100% disabled veterans who come from Oregon to Oregon from other states, particularly Montana, kind of a neighboring state. And in Montana, they have that 100% exemption for 100% service-connected disabled veterans. We're supportive of this increased property tax exemption. Just got some new data on the service-connected disabled veterans in Oregon from the FedVA VetraSpec system but from the FedVA system, there are roughly 7,600 100% service-connected disabled veterans in the state. Now, not all of those owned homes. I think there is another statistics that roughly 60% of people in the state own homes, so perhaps a kind of a ballpark figure of that might be 60% of that 7,600. Thank you.
Questions, colleagues? I'm sure Chris can carry that information back. Having said that, if there's no other testimony, I'm going to close the public hearing on 53, 54, and 434. Colleagues, unless you have a better suggestion, I'm going to plan to schedule work sessions on all three tax bills next week because we have to make a recommendation one way or the other, up or down, or straddle the fence to the next committee. So these have to come out of us and go anyway. And that being 53, 54, and 434.
It'd be nice if you could, or if our administrator could, there are questions that they ask us to answer, and that's what the revenue
right exactly
the appendix D, and it'd be nice to know how we're going to answer those.
Well, council's going to take the first stab at writing the first three sets, and then you and I are going to edit them, Madam Co-Chair, because...
I would recommend
Mr. Chair,
that.
Members of the committee, Senate Bills 53 and 54 are the only two that are referred to Joint Tax Credits Committee, and Senator Olson's Senate Bill 494 has got a subsequent referral to Finance and Revenue, and if I'm correct, the last time this was introduced, it got a revenue light when we requested impact statements, because they look at it in more depth when it gets to the next committee. But for the 53 and 54, I can take a whack at
the
draft.
Yeah,
And for all practical purposes, it's the same committee.
Using the appendix to the Legislative Revenue Report, correct?
Right, and I serve as the vice chair of both those committees. Okay, so that's why I'm saying you're going to take a whack at all three, because we have to answer all those three for the chairs in those. And then in addition to that, SCR 6, scheduled for a work session next time, which is the memorial. Senator Bates is 494, unless anybody has something else to say. And then we'll schedule a work group in the middle of next week sometime for Senate Bill 95. And then we're looking on some more language for 531. And if everybody is fine with that, 432 is the 911.
Correct.
Schedule that for a work session next week, and we'll have a discussion in the meantime. That way we can start moving bills or not moving bills. And with that, colleagues, unless somebody else has a comment, the committee is adjourned. Okay.